I think as Christians, we sometimes forget that Jesus was profoundly Jewish from his head to his little toe. And this story of the Transfiguration reminds us of that and the following on bit that you talked about, that it had Moses and Elijah, and it also had the ethical dimensions that followed the Transfiguration itself, what the people had to do when they came down from the mountain. Is that how you would see it? That's how I place Jesus in that setting too, as a Jew.
Jenny, the question is, do I see this as a typically Jewish story that somehow or other enlarges the Christian vision? Absolutely. Remember that the Jewish community is immersed in a concept of the Holy of Holies, of moving in to that area of life where the high priest contacts God. Now, in a sense, the Transfiguration of Jesus plays on the Holy of Holies in the temple. We go up a high mountain where heaven touches earth, where the high priest, our high priest, is transfigured, obviously like Moses, a glow on the top of Mount Sinai. But then at the end of the story, does not see the climax of the story as the end of the story. This contacting God, melting into God, becoming consumed with the fire and light of God is not enough. The story's very clear about that. And it has always affected me, this story, that it was the apostles, the ones that we thought were already enlightened, the chief apostles, Peter, James, and John, who want to stay on the mountain. They have completely lost the whole notion of Emmanuel, of God with us, of the living God in the covenanted community. So that trip down the mountain is far more impacting, certainly to the Jewish mind, and far more revealing to the Christian mind that staying in the Holy of Holies is not what this is about. So I thank you for that. It's not our imagination. It is playing on some very strong Jewish themes and then catapulting them into a world that was clearly not at that point at all.
Given that, as a solo parent, as a woman living in New Zealand, as trying to be self-supporting and all that kind of stuff, at what point is enough? Enough, you know, like I want to be the best Christian I can be, you know? And there's only so many hours in the day, and there's X number of bills to pay, and all that stuff, you know? What
Thanks.
Do you do?
Great question, an important one. That kind of a question is exactly the kind, in my opinion, I'm Roman. I'm absolutely convinced that was an older catechesis, that somehow or other the sacred and the secular were two different parts of life, that we separated them. For the Roman Catholic, for instance, even for nuns, we had cloistered nuns and active nuns, and acted as if cloister was a synonym for contemplative, and that this was a holier way to be holy than this was. The fact of the matter is, it is who you are, where you are, while you're doing what you must do, that brings those two things together in your life. We're not talking about joining another commission. We're not talking about setting up another committee. We're not talking about protesting in the streets. All those things are necessary dimensions of the organized voice of the Christian heart, of the human heart. But that's not what your own connecting of these two dimensions of life is about. Who are you at the office water machine? What do you talk about when you know, in that letter to the Philippians, the second reading, when he says, your standards must be different. What standards do you bring where you go while you're doing what you must do to be the best possible Christian you can be? Don't separate them. That's what this gospel is saying. You can't separate them. They're of a piece. You fill your own heart, and you speak that heart wherever you are. That's what changes the universal mind. That's what changes the mind of the people. That's what makes the impossible unbearable for us all. It's not a project. It's a process. It's a presence. It's a way of bringing different standards into the marketplace. Does that make sense? Yeah. But you're right, it's the trap. It's the great Christian trap. I'm just too busy, and honey, so am I. I haven't served a cup of soup for so many years. The only thing I can do about soup is be honest about it. But I'll tell you what I do, I legitimate the serving of soup. So wherever we are, in whatever stage we are in a population that is also looking, trying to be the best possible people they can be. And the standards that you take with you will elevate the nature of that group.
Joan, thank you for being with us here today. Would you care to comment on your position in the Global Peace Initiative of Women?
The Global Peace Initiative of Women is a kind of a bold thing. Nobody asked us to do it. Nobody said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a Global Peace Initiative of Women? We just decided that what was missing from the human agenda was the woman's agenda and the woman's presence and the woman's attitude toward what is security and how do you get it. For instance, in my country, we have decided we make nuclear weapons and we have the nerve to call it defense. Nobody has asked the women of my country if they want to be defended that way at all. So we decided to tell them that we didn't. And we also decided that we are not alone. So we put together a commission of a Hindu nun, a Buddhist nun, a Jewish Orthodox, an Orthodox Jewish woman, an ordained Protestant clergywoman, this little erstwise Roman Catholic nun, and a lay convener. And a Sufi woman. And we go into areas of conflict. If you don't have a problem, you won't see us. We went in, for instance, to Palestine and Israel, the six of us together. To bring opposites together all the time, and we start with women. We don't bar men, but we make sure that it's a woman's meeting. So we brought Palestinian women and Israeli women into the same set of conferences. It was a lot of effort trying to raise the amount of money that it takes to bring people like that together was phenomenal. But we were able in that group to make connections between the Palestinian and the Israeli women, that still, in the middle of that terrible tragedy there, those women are trying to reach across boundaries. Now, every single thing in their world stops them from it, those checkpoints. If Israeli women go through the checkpoints, they will be jailed. They'll be arrested. If the Palestinian women attempt to get through the checkpoints, they'll be arrested. And yet, somehow or other, these women and a group called the Parents' Circle, women, Israeli women and Palestinian women, both of whom have had children killed by the other side, now carry the pictures of one another's children. They come to every mixed group and light the candles of the Parents' Circle. It's an attempt, oh, it's meager, and it's mild, and it's nothing. And yet, the something of it is that women who are seen as professional religious figures simply go into an area and say, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Sufi, there is absolutely nothing in the sacred texts that can justify what is going on here. Do not see yourselves, you know, as fighting for God's land. Do not see yourselves as reclaiming the holy space. The only thing that will be holy about this is when you stop it. And you can see these women, they know. It's their children who are being starved and burned out and harassed in the streets and bombed on the buses. And they know that what's going on is not working. So the only way to do this thing is to keep these populations open and flowing. And if we have to take them out of their own country to do it, and we've done it 3 times, we do it. It's not easy, but we do it. We're going to India soon to work with Hindu and Islamic women for the very same reason, trying to just seed. You know, it's a, there's a story in my own life that maybe won't have much the impact if you don't know anything about segregation in the United States. When I was a very little girl, someplace along the line, I had heard about black people. I had never seen a black person. I lived in a small town in the United States. They weren't there. So I said to my mother, "Mother, did you ever see a black person?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Did you like them?" And she said, "Yes, they were fine people, Joan. They're people." I said, "Well, how do you know that you like them?" And she said, "Well, I'll tell you a story." She said, in an age when diphtheria was a very feared disease, Grandpa got sick. And the fear was that he had diphtheria, so they quarantined the house. My grandmother had 13 children. There were still at least 9 or 10 of them at home. They bought their food a day at a time because there were no labor unions at that time. It was all day labor. He would go into the mines and he'd get a little money at the end of the day. To quarantine the man of the house in that period was to starve the family. So the word got around this small, very Christian, very white little enclave. There was one black family. They lived on the other side of the border of the county. One morning there was a knock on the door, my mother said. And when she and my grandmother looked out the window, thinking they weren't permitted even to open it, there stood the only black woman in town with a big bag over her hand with eggs in it. And she called, Mrs., you open the door and I'll roll the egg. And she rolled 13 eggs that Grandma caught and put in her own basket. Every day for 6 weeks, that woman took the eggs from her own sitting chickens. She walked for miles into the center of the city, and she yelled every morning, Mrs., you open the door and I'll roll the eggs. My mother said to me, you see, darling, good people are good people. The color has nothing to do with their goodness. What you have to do, Joan, when you grow up, is you must remember that you have an obligation to roll eggs. That's what we learned from the Callahans on the other side of town. I carry that. I carry that story. I carry that family. And I argued that if we could just bring women from opposing political positions, opposing religious positions together, and give them the opportunity to be women, to do what women do. They say, "Hello, what's your name? How many kids do you have? Where do you live? Gee, you look very much like, do you really? Oh, come tonight, let's talk." They say that when men walk into a group, social psychologists tell us that when men walk into a group, they immediately assess the group. They decide which alpha male has the power, and they decide if they're going to join him or fight him. When women walk into a group, the minute they get there, they sit down and they say, "My God, you look just like my Aunt Betty. Did you know her? What's your name?" And they sit down and they begin to share tea and cookies. That's the only security left on this globe. the sharing of tea and cookies. We come here every Sunday and we model the sharing of tea and cookies. The problem is we don't know how real that sharing must be. What strangers have you brought into your home recently? Yeah. Who have you fed that you didn't know? Where did you go to talk to people you'd never met before and don't have a chance to meet? You got to build a new church. We have to be it. We have to find differences. It's not the time now to hide in our comfort zone. At least once a month, we've got to go out of our comfort zone into our differences to find out how much alike we really are.
We're having a debate in this country, Joan, at the moment about are we a Christian nation? And certainly we've had discussions in this congregation about that, and most of us, I would think, probably feel fairly uncomfortable about that concept. I've just come back from your country yesterday, and there they're talking about the questions that they're asking the politicians, which are to some extent phrased in the same sort of way. I wondered if you could just comment on that, because it's something which is, I think, generating heat, and I suspect there's a campaign about it vis-a-vis Muslim nations and other things.
It's a phenomenal tension in the United States of America. It's a scary tension. This whole notion that we must define ourselves as a Christian nation. The fact of the matter is we were not founded as a Christian nation. We were not founded by Christians. We were founded by deists. It was a country under God, whoever, whatever, whosoever God it is. But Jesus and Christianity as an established church or religion had absolutely nothing to do with the founding of the United States. Try telling that to Americans. I mean, by God, defend yourself if you ever get in that discussion. It's a very important question now. Why? Because all the borders are seeping. There are no such thing as borders anymore, really. I said to a group yesterday, the thing that I remember most about Ireland, the very first time I was in Ireland, they drove me through the middle of Dublin, and there was this gorgeous building going up here in the corner. And I said, what is that? And they said, that's a $20 million state-of-the-art mosque. Mosque! I expected to see my grandmother come up through the cement on the sidewalk. This was Dublin, for God's sake. You don't have mosques in Dublin. Now, the fact of the matter is, as secular states, all religions are safe. As religious states, few religions are safe. The whole notion that in the United States of America, we have had legal fights about whether or not judges sitting on benches should have behind the bench an icon of the Ten Commandments. Now, if you are Muslim and you know Sharia law, how much justice do you expect for you under Jewish commandments? The mind of the rest of the world, at least some parts of it, is very, very different. It's only a secular state that really guarantees the religious freedom of all religions. So we're finding ourselves in a very difficult moment. For the very first time in American history, a representative was sworn in November with his hand on the Quran. Oh, it sent a shiver through the country. You know, how could this be? But what could be more telling than the fact that sacred comes in many faces and many tongues around this world? So I don't expect this discussion to go away. It's why? Because we've had so much fear pumped into us in the United States that the very notion that we are under attack from the entire Muslim community is just an astounding feeling for us. But we're going to have to get beyond it if we are going to really preserve the democracy which we say we're based, I think. But I can tell you that short answer will not adequately prepare you for the fight that follows.
Thank you, Joan. Thank you very much.